You green and rocky mountains, you skies so big and blue, with dreams beyond the counting, you know that I love you. And you will not forsake me. You'll stand so wild and strong till all the stars fall from the sky and all the dreams are gone. My mama died so weary. My daddy's gone too. They left me sad and sorry with nothing I could do. But when I see your rivers wind, my heart sings like a bird that leaves my sorrows far behind. The sweetest song I've heard. Now I will wander o'er the earth, from sea to shining sea, but nothing I find will be worth the song you sing to me. And when at last my time is done, and all my trials are through, I'll hang my coat behind the door and lay me down with you.
You just heard the song Oregon Mountain Chant by Marnie Alberton. Thanks, Marnie. If anyone listening has a nature-related song that they've written that they'd like to share on Living Downstream, please email ryan@umphawatersheds.org. All right, let's start the show. Welcome to another episode of Living Downstream, and happy Mother's Day to any moms, grandmas, nanas, godmothers, and other maternal figures, as well as, of course, Mother Earth. One of the best ways to love your mother is to show her appreciation. And one way to do this, at least when it comes to Mother Nature, is by spending time getting to know and love your local environment. In today's episode, we'll hear from local author Robert Leo Heilman about building community and what it means to be a part of this place, the Umpqua Watershed. Before we jump into the interview, I want to pause for a land acknowledgement, a reminder that we are not the only people who have tended the land and waters in this space. Other groups came before us, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Malala, and others. Here with Robert Leo Heilman, a local author who's written about some of his experiences with the land in this place. To start off, can you share a little of your background, maybe some of your experiences with the land and how you got started with writing?
I moved up here in 1975 from Los Angeles, my wife and I, 23 years old at the time. That was 46 years ago. So I've lived here for quite a while. prior to moving here, I was doing construction kind of stuff down in the Los Angeles area, house painting, carpentry, and a few other things, moving and hauling and whatnot. When I got up here, I couldn't find work in the construction business. So there was a great prejudice against hippies. And so I ended up working out in the woods instead. So because that's the bottom of the local social order around here is planting trees. So I started doing that instead. And picked up some logging and started doing a few contracts with BLM here and there. We did a cone picking project one time, picking up fir cones for $10 a bushel, if I remember right. Had a shade card staking contract for 10 cents a card with BLM. And did eventually start going back to doing some roofing in the summertime. So I just had a kind of a cyclic thing going there. Or plant trees in the winter, peel poles down at the pole yard. We used to hand peel poles and for 7 cents a foot, I think, linear foot. And then onto some roofing in the summer and back to tree planting again. And trying to draw as much unemployment as I could in between. That went on for, till about, till 1980, the fall of 1980, I was doing a roofing job. And the ladder I was standing on twisted out from underneath me. So I fell headfirst across my shoulder and back of my head and neck. Was pretty severely injured. And found that I really couldn't take the stress of planting trees anymore. So I was home. My wife had had a son while I was working in the mill. Thank God, because it's the only time for many years there where we actually had health insurance. And so little Kurt was a year and a half old, almost two. And so I ended up staying home and being a stay-at-home dad because I couldn't work and my wife had to make some money, so she went out. And so I started writing as a way to keep from going crazy. The accident plunged me into the world of workers' compensation. Insurance fights and problems, and it's a very humiliating thing. It's a funny system in which you're considered to be guilty of malingering unless you can prove otherwise, which is backwards from American jurisprudence, but there it is. And so one thing or another, I started writing and have been stuck with it ever since.
How common is it for people who are working in, whether it's, construction or logging or planting? How common is it that people are getting injured?
It's very common. It's very, very common. People don't realize just how common it is, actually. Thousands of people every year are injured on the job. There's a wonderful book out by Earl Dodder called Quiet Sickness. He was a photographer and he took on a project of photographing people who had been injured and all of that. And in the process, he ran across a sign that out in front of some an injured worker's house that said Quiet Sickness. This was a case of black lung, actually. So a lot of what he was dealing with was black lung among coal miners, but there's also white lung among textile workers, which was a very common thing that killed young women back in 100 years ago. Many women died in their late teens, early 20s from having started working in the mill at the age of 6 or 7 years old and breathing cotton dust the whole time. But it's very common, especially in your higher risk jobs, such as roofing and logging, commercial fishing, these sorts of things. These death rates actually in some of these are higher than they are, for example, law enforcement, which people consider to be a very dangerous job. But so it's quite common.
Yeah, it's crazy to think about if you're not in it, right? You know, I was reading Overstory Zero, and I'll ask some questions specifically about that book later. But yeah, it's just kind of eye-opening for me, having not been involved in directly in the timber industry or with replanting, and also not really being, you know, I'm not from this place either. I'm from the Northeast. So just learning about just a different way that people are living and things that they're experiencing. Yeah, so I guess what... kind of drawing back to what you were saying before, what type of things did you start to write about? Like when you started writing, like what were you writing about?
Well, at first I was trying to write fiction. I figured, you know, if you're going to be a writer, that's what you got to do. You know, you have to write fiction. You have to write stories and novels, such like mm-hmm. stuff. So there was that. I've used to do some other writing and essay sort of stuff as well. But early on, it was all really pretty pretentious kind of stuff and not well thought out. My fiction especially tended to be idea-driven rather than being driven by character and plot. So, I kind of wanted to be another Steinbeck or something, but it just wasn't really what was happening. My break, as far as getting published, came through journalism. The very first thing I ever had published was a review of the novels of a French writer by the name of Jean Giono, who's a wonderful, wonderful writer. From there, I got involved with a magazine. It was called Siskiyou Country. It came out of Tukilma, Oregon. It was a bioregionalist thing. Basically, it was environmentalism. It's really what it was. A bunch of hippies down there in Tukilma who had been blocking roads and such, Earth Firster kind of people and all of that, had this magazine. And I could get my stuff in print. They never had any money. I never got paid for any of that. But that's how you start out, you know. In the writing business, it's kind of like working your way up through, sports, baseball. You know, you start out in little league and work your way up, you know, and to high school ball and college ball and the minor leagues and the low minors and the mid league and eventually, if you're lucky, you make it to the majors, if you have the talent and the drive and all that. So writing's kind of like that. So it starts out generally for most people is pays and copies. You know, you get to see your name in print on top of something. You know, you have a byline, and that's a huge thrill the first time it happens. From there, you move on to, well, back in the day anyway, it was about a dime a word. 10 cents a word and on up. And it took a long time for me. It took me, 4 years to get my first byline. 2 years after that, before I actually got paid for doing anything. It was radio work, actually. At the time, I wrote a feature for a project called the Bioregional Report that used to air on KSOR out of Ashland. So it was after that outfit, the Siskiyou Regional Education Project, I wrote for them quite a bit, did a lot of journalism for them, news reporting, and there was an interview. The thing came out 6 times a year, and I would have a feature interview every other month in there and did a lot of that. Well, they finally went belly up. And about the same time, I started selling to the Oregonian. the Sunday Oregonian, and sold an essay to them, a 1,000-word piece for $100, which I managed to sell the same thing twice. I sold it also to a magazine in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, called The Sun, and Sisa Fransky there, and got another 100 out of it. And so I started getting into that more, figuring out, the hell, this is some easy money, and if I stick with it, eventually I'll have enough of it to keep the covers of a book apart. And I didn't realize that it would take me 7 years to do that. But in 1994, I managed to sell a collection of my essays to Sasquatch Books out of Seattle. And it did really well. Sold 6,000 copies for them. And I brought it out as a second edition, actually, back in 2014. And it's sold over 1,000 copies since then, self-published. So it's done rather well.
That sounds like writing is really a process. Yeah, I'm interested in writing myself. And I've been just kind of dabbling, yeah, a little in, you know, just some fiction. But so you decided to switch to like more nonfiction essay, you said. And I was noticing too with Overstory Zero that there are a lot of, you incorporated a lot of different stories about your life or your experiences. I guess, can you just share, what's the significance of the title Overstory Zero?
The overstory refers to the top layer of a canopy in a forest. That's the top layer of the branches and leaves that the trees have at the highest level. So that's the overstory. Underneath that, you'll find understories. So shorter trees, shorter species of trees, brush, things like that. You might have several understories, actually. But when you're planting trees on a clear cut, there is no overstory or understory. And so it measures zero. It was early 90s. I wrote that piece for Left Bank magazine. The Stovalls, Denny and Lynn Stovall up in Hillsboro had a twice a year literary magazine that came out like a paperback book, a nice thick thing with photography, some poetry, and essays. And they did a theme issue called Gotta Make a Living. And so I wrote this piece about tree planting. I tried to write about a day in the life of a tree planter. I never actually made it all the way to lunch, but there it was. And in the process of writing that, I got to thinking about something that really bothered me when I was planting trees, which is the semantics of silviculture, which is what foresters call growing trees, silviculture. And the semantics of it do not allow for to actually come out and say what's going on. Basically, everything's kind of keeps it covered up and in nice little terms that aren't too terribly threatening. For example, although tree planting is called reforestation, logging is never called deforestation, which is in fact what it is. I mean, there's a forest there and then there is no forest. So it's gone, you know. So anyway, I wrote about that and used that phrase in there. And then I later decided that that should be the title for the essay, which in turn became the title for the book. The title was picked out by a committee at Sasquatch Books, editor's editorial committee looked at it, and they didn't like my title, which was going to be 100 Valleys, since it was all about the Umpqua, 100 Valleys of the Umpqua Country. The original working title was Manual Labor and Other Things Not Taught in School, but it ended up being called Overstory Zero, Real Life in Timber Country. And you know, you got to let them do what they're going to do, especially when it comes to titles. It's one of the things I've found in working as a writer over the years is you go ahead and give in on whatever title the editor wants to give it, because that way it gives you more ammunition later when there's significant changes that you really want to argue in favor of, you know. Oh man, I let you have the title, like, you know. They picked it out. They decided to call it after that, and that in turn was, you know, it's a common thing, actually, is naming a collection after one of the more significant stories or essays in the collection.
Yeah, I didn't realize how often also that editors contribute to the naming of the book. I don't know. Yeah, because that's one of the things that I feel like I'll be most excited about is picking the title. So it's just kind of an interesting thing. So it's helpful to hear about your experience as an author as well.
You're listening to an episode of Living Downstream on KQUA, brought to you by Umpqua Watersheds. In this next segment, we'll hear about the importance of being open to different perspectives and seeing complexities.
What has the feedback been about your various books, considering that you're writing about your experience, you know, locally a lot of the time?
Very positive, really. Very, very minimal amount of static. At one point, I was told that someone had suggested my book to someone, and the reply was, oh, him, he's one of those eco-terrorists, okay, I guess. I don't know what that means exactly, but there it is. So, but no, people like it. It's one of the advantages of talking about controversial matters through personal experience essay is that it's a personal experience you're talking about. You know, I was there, this or that happened, this is what I saw, this is what I heard, this is how I felt about it. And so it's very difficult to for somebody to come at that and attack it on the basis of it being somehow false or stupid or whatever, because it's just a personal experience being described, you see. So there's an advantage in that. When you're dealing with controversial stuff, which some of the stuff that's in there is, in fact, you was dealing with some very controversial things, you know, about forest management and all of that. But that's a position of strength that it allows. So one of the most common comments I get from people is that particular book is well balanced. You see, that a lot of the critics, especially, it was reviewed 36 times, actually, in some fairly major publications, the LA Times, Washington Post, and whatnot. And that was one of the most common, you know, comments, you know, about it was that there was a balance to it. And that, I think, really comes from my strong belief in complexity. You see, I get nervous when people talk about complex matters in simplistic terms. I think that leads to a great deal of trouble in the world. That's not something I want to contribute to. So we, you know, when you can do that, and when you can understand the community you live in, the people you live among, to write requires, indeed any form of art, but writing especially, requires a suppression of the ego. It requires a deal of humility, because to write well, you have to observe. You see, you have to keep your eyes open and actually see. And without imposing yourself upon the situation, but to actually see what is going on and why, and who are these people that are doing what they're doing. And all of that requires that you back off from it, that you take this kind of neutral observational stance with things. And over the years of practicing the art, or selling craft is you develop this habit of I wouldn't call it being non-judgmental exactly, because, well, for one thing, to be lacking in judgment is not necessarily a good thing, is it? You know, to be fair, you know, to treat things fairly and just see what's actually, try your best to see what is exactly actually going on, and to to roll with that, you know. So so it comes out more balanced that way. But the balance is a product of the process of being a writer. It's inherent in it, because you can't write well if what you're writing is always slanted one way or another, if your purpose is to promote some ideological end or other. George Orwell wrote a wonderful essay called Politics in the English Language, in which he just trashes political speech wonderfully well. And some very important things in there that, to consider just how trite so much of the political speech is, over-reliance on cliches and things, you know, just poor writing, terrible writing, you know, it's boring. And that is the great sin for any writer, is to be boring, you know. You owe it to your reader to do a good job. They're taking their time to listen to you. Why should they listen to you? Why should they care what you wrote, you know? Well, they should care because you're being a good companion, because you're teaching them something they didn't know, or reminding them of something they had forgotten, and being a good companion in the process. And if you can't do those, then, you know, hang it up. Otherwise, it's mere expression. It's not communication, you see.
Yeah, that was something I appreciated about Overstory Zero, your book. That you did present things in a kind of balanced, like sort of neutral way. Here's my experience. This is what happened. You know, this is what I saw. But I think in doing so, it lets the reader, like, it gives the reader an opportunity to then kind of formulate their own thoughts about it, and maybe come to different conclusions than they might if they come with an open mind. I think in a different interview, or maybe the book club or something that you attended, you mentioned that sometimes when you would be with environmentalists, you'd talk like a logger. And when you were with loggers, you'd talk like environmentalists, which I was, when I first heard that, I was thinking, yeah, some people probably think that's just kind of contrary. but then if you really think about it, it's good to have people think about the other side, you know, or a different perspective. Yeah, so I felt like that was just kind of interesting that you said that, and then also I saw that in your writing as well.
Yeah, it's amazing how, again, simplistic people take things. I'll give you an interesting example. One of my neighbors, he's passed away now, but old Fred, he'd go on and on about this or that or the other thing, old man. But we were having lunch one day at Little Susie's Cafe, and he went off on something about these environmentalists shutting down timber sales, you know. These environmentalists always shutting down the timber sales, you know. Well, and I just had to tell him, I said, look, Fred, environmentalists don't shut down timber sales, man. It's federal judges who shut them down. And the reason they shut them down is because those sales are illegal. The legal ones go through. It's the illegal ones that get shut down, you know. And then I told him about this friend of mine who worked for the Forest Service for a lot of years as an editor. His job was to write these environmental impact statements and logging plans and things, harvest plans, excuse me, since that's what they call them. And I got to talking to him about it one time, and he said, yeah, he said, you know, I've had about a dozen of mine were challenged in court. Environmental groups challenged him in court. He said, all but one of them, the sales were shut down. He said, the one that wasn't shut down happened because I went to the supervisor and I said, we have to change this. It's not going to fly. It'll get shut down unless we change this. We're going to have to make some modifications to this plan to make it legal. And he was told, yeah, go ahead and make the changes. Well, all the other times he went to the supervisors, and he worked on several different forests, and said, we need to change this. And they said, no, go ahead and write it up the way it is. So who's at fault here, you know? But in the public mind, in the simplistic world of timber politics, you know, I mean, if you ask, talk to the county commissioners, they'll tell you it's environmentalists shut down timber sales. Well, no, you don't want your sales to be shut down. Tell the Forest Service supervisors to stop okaying illegal sales, and then they won't get shut down. You know, I mean, it's crazy. If you try to explain that to people, they don't want to hear it. They would much rather say, same damn eco-terrorist people, you know.
What makes the timber sales that are illegal, what makes them illegal?
Well, they don't live up to the, they don't follow all the rules involved in making those sales. The National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, governs all of that. And so there are certain things that have to be done ahead of time. The timber sales departments of national forests tend to want to skip steps and to push the envelope as far as how much they can get, because their mindset is get out as much wood as we can, as fast as we can, you know. And so their mindset is not keeping a healthy, thriving forest going in a sustainable way. So that's what makes them illegal. This is that they don't follow the rules. There are rules that are set. There are certain steps you have to take. And generally, these involve taking things into consideration, like wildlife habitat. You know, what is the potential for wildlife habitat loss? That's usually the one that comes to the attention of environmental groups that launch these lawsuits and haul them into court, you know, and say, no, you can't get rid of all these wolves. No, you can't let all these owls die. You have to provide for the fish, you know, you have to provide for the water quality. But you can't be shortcutting all the time. But every time that they do follow the rules, it means smaller logging sales. So there's less volume coming out. And that's why the mill owners don't like it and why the county commissioners don't like it and why the timber sales people don't like it.
We'll be right back after a few brief announcements. Umpqua Watersheds is now offering opportunities for youths to have their voices heard, literally, on our radio program, Living Downstream. Kids ages 8 to 18 are invited to submit a 1 to 3 minute audio recording describing what they love about the place in which they live. These could be poems, essays, stories, or songs. We welcome their creativity. Submissions should be sent to our environmental education and outreach leader at ryan@umpquawatersheds.org with youth entry, sense of place, in the subject line. This is a great opportunity for families and classes alike. Let's learn why unsustainable practices continue and when liquidating the assets can mean destroying habitat.
I was thinking, though, you know, when people go and whether it's people or corporations and clear cut, technically that's not a sustainable way to do it, right? There's a lot of evidence that's saying that this is harmful to the environment. I mean, that habitat is lost altogether, even if you do replant, because it takes a long time for the trees to grow. And there's that loss of diversity if they're all the same type of, you know, like monoculture. So like my question coming out here from back east, I don't know, the question that keeps coming up in my mind is why are people or corporations still going back and harvesting in that unsustainable way. If, like, if we think, you know, down the line a little ways, like, we can't just keep doing that because there won't be the forest left. You know, if we keep cutting all of the forest or big chunks of forest as opposed to kind of a little at a time, then won't we just run out? Like, at some point, you know, our consumption will outpace the ability of nature to regrow.
Yeah. The reason that it's short-term profit is to simply say it, you know, it really is. Great deal of the so-called private timber that we have, and that's a term that really bothers me. It's actually corporate timber for the most part. But a good deal of that is owned by investment companies, you know. And so they don't live here. They don't really care. You know, they just don't. You know, quarterly dividends is why they exist. They're there to increase profits, provide profits, money to investors. That's their purpose. Their purpose is not to sustain a community. It's not to protect the environment. These are very limited in their outlook. Sociopathic, really. I mean, when you get right down, no, seriously. Henry Thoreau in Civil Disobedience, that famous essay of his, wrote, is truly enough said that a corporation has no conscience, but a corporation of conscientious men is a corporation with a conscience. So what we have is unconscientious corporations. We have corporations that commit unconscionable practices. We had a very famous case, of course, down in Northern California with the Palco Pacific Lumber Company. It was bought out by, what's his name? Hurwitz, I believe it was. He's one of these corporate raider guys. Some of the last privately owned redwood forest down in Northern California that had been managed sustainably for many, many years by Pacific Lumber Company. There was a leverage buyout, and he decided to liquidate the assets, which turned out to be, of course, the forest. Same thing happened here in Oregon. That's one people don't talk about much for some reason, but Medford Corporation, the town of Butte Falls, had been a company town for, 100 years probably. Sustainably managed. I mean, they had a logging plan that went out for 40 years ahead, and at the end of that 40 years, they would have had just as much or more timber than when they started. I mean, it was all selective logging, very carefully managed and all of that. So this corporate raider guy who happened to own Amalgamated Sugar down in Texas bought it out and liquidated the asset, which was to say all of the timber. They took that 40 years worth of timber and cut it all in 10 years, cut down the last two big trees right up in front of the office there in Butte Falls, sent them through the mills, shut down the business altogether, paid off the loan that it took to buy that land, made a profit, and blamed it all on the spotted owl, the damn environmentalists, people out of work, you know. So that was the line. That's the way that went. So to me, this is a major question, this question of conscientiousness, the use of a human conscience, making decisions. How can we provide corporations with a conscience? How can we make them more humane? When the Soviet Union was in its death throes back in the 1980s for a while there, in the time of glasnost and perestroika and all of the talked of socialism with a human face. This is, they were going to reform communism and make it more humane. Well, I remember thinking at the time, well, what about capitalism with a human face? Now, wouldn't that be nice? You know, can we have that? We know that it works on a small scale, that a local business can be run very humanely, that decent people who feel that they're part of their community and who treat their workers well and provide a good service and everything's, you know, I mean, honest people who actually give a damn. But when you get to the point where some Wall Street investment house is making decisions about what happens to the Umpqua National Forest or to all this thousands and thousands and thousands of acres of timberlands, then how do you do that? How can you change that? How can you convince people that, listen, if you have less profit, it's a good thing? Well, they don't believe it. They do not believe. They believe that there is no limit to profit. Profit is good. It is sacred. It is holy. To attack profit is communism. It's horrible, you know. This is a, you know, Milton Friedman, of course, is famous for all that kind of attitude, which came in the 60s. Prior to that, corporations tended to be more humane. And it's sad what's become of it now, but there it is. It's again this simplification, right? That if what is profitable is good and what is not profitable is bad, and that's the extent of your morality, then you are acting in the same way that a sociopath would act, aren't you? You know, it is. It really is. It's sociopathy. It is bad for society. It is very bad for society, you know. And so we're facing that all across the board, not just here in the Pacific Northwest, but everywhere around the world, and not just in forests and things like that, but all sorts of things, you know, all sorts of things. It creeps into politics now, you know. You have zero-sum politics and such, you know. Winning is everything, you know, even if it means destroying democracy in the process, you know. This scorched earth approach to politics, the short-term win is what's important. And the future, why talk about the future? It's not here, you know. We'll figure out something, but for now, let's make lots of money.
We'll be back shortly. Umpqua Watersheds is now offering opportunities for youths to have their voices heard on our radio program. Kids ages 8 to 18 are invited to submit a 1 to 3 minute audio recording describing a positive change they'd make in their community if given the power to do so. Entries could be in the form of essays, stories, raps, songs, you name it. Please send submissions to our AmeriCorps member at ryan@umpquawatersheds.org with youth entry, making positive change, in the subject line. Teachers and parents, reach out if you'd like to learn more. Do you have a photograph which captures the natural beauty of the Umpqua watershed? Umpqua Watersheds is compiling photos which highlight the splendor of this region. We're collecting images of native flora and fauna, as well as landscape scenes, to feature on our website and use in a calendar that we're putting together for 2022. If you'd like to contribute a photograph, please email ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. Again, that's ryan@umpquawatersheds.org, with scenes of the Umpqua in the subject line. Thank you in advance. What makes up a real community? Let's find out.
Have you found anything that gets people to be open to a different perspective? Or like has anything worked to get people to like listen to the other side?
There are ways of doing it. Back in the early 90s, Bob Allen and I, along with Beverly Paulson, actually, there were three of us. I was at it was a camp out, actually, at Twin Lakes with Umpqua Watersheds. I was up there and got to talking to Bob Allen around the campfire one night. And I told him about this process that had been developed in Colorado. And what they had done was they had brought two opposing groups. In this case, it was pro-life and reproductive rights people, pro-reproductive rights, pro-anti-abortion, you know, pro-abortion, I don't know, But anyway, they were opposed. And they brought them together and asked them to plan an event together. And in the process, of course, they got to know each other. And so that seemed to help some, you know. Eventually, they said, listen, you just come up with something that you can both support together, okay? And in that particular case, they had decided, we want to support increased adoption. Why not, okay? You know, if you don't want women having abortions, then you got to do something with the kids. And hey, we're in favor of life. We're not opposed to children, you know. We're, so yes, we can support that too. So, okay, here's something we can work together. Let's develop this program together to help encourage people to do that. So we decided to Bob and I decided to I proposed it to Bob, and about a month later, he called me up and said he wanted to give it a try. And so we did it. We got a hold of three timber industry activists. One who later became a county commissioner, the daughter of a mill owner and car dealer guy who had come out very strong in favor of the timber industry and all the timber wars crap. And so we talked them into working with us to plan a conference at the community college. We called it Shaping Our Future. And so we sat down with them. We had a series of meetings. I taught them how to do consensus decision making, which they'd never heard of, naturally. Everything that we happened, you know, we picked out who was going to speak, and it was a unanimous decision among the six of us as to what we would do, what order it would happen in, who the guest speakers would be for the panels, what would the panels discuss. Laid out the entire thing together. And it seemed to help some at the time, tone things down a bit. Later on, one told me that the timber folks had been scared to death of the conference. It was very frightening to them, the notion that, you know. But nevertheless, we talked them into participating, and I think it helped, you know. So often we get caught up in ideologies, in positions, political positions and things, and all of that. And we ignore the reality around us, you know. So many people these days, I find, see themselves as members of what I would call a community of interest. A sort of metaphorical community. You hear about these all these times. The religious community, you know, like, yeah, the Catholic Church goes on vacation, and you know, the Buddhist and the Dalai Lama Pope goes on vacation, so the Dalai Lama comes by and feeds the cat and picks up the newspaper and says, I mean, it's not a real community. It's as if it were a community, which it really actually isn't, you know. And so you end up with these absurdities, these notions of finding common ground, you know. Well, look at your feet. There it is, the ground. Guess what? We have it in common, okay? We all walk the same ground in a real community, you see. Real communities have zip codes, okay? They really do. You know, the rest of these are metaphorical communities. They're not real. They're just as if they were a community, which they're not, okay? They're just not. The international business community, the environmental community, you know, these are absurdities. These are absurdities, and they can lead to some very serious and very terrible consequences when that's what you rely on, is your shared belief system, your shared interests, your shared cause, you know. And instead of the actual place where you live. The Germans have a word, it's called Heimat. Your Heimat, you know, your Heimat. It's usually translated as homeland. And, but of course, it doesn't translate well into English. because, you know, I mean, this is America. Nobody has a homeland in America. A homeland is someplace that everybody left a long time ago for one reason or another. So, you know, maybe foreigners have homelands, but, you know, not really, not here. So, but your Heimat is where you live. It's your daily experienced world. And so it's very narrow geographically. It's a place, it's a real place. It's very expansive though, in terms of what it involves, because it brings in history, it brings in the ecology, the environment, the culture, the arts, the customs and ways of doing things. These are all part and parcel of your Heimat, you see. So, but people, you know, we move about so much in this country. I mean, and that it's a fact that less than half the people who are living in Oregon have been here for more than 10 years. So there's no permanence there. There's this shifting around of populations of people, and they come and they go. When you move to some place where you have no experience, you're bound to make mistakes. I mean, that's just the way it works. You know, you come here from Alabama and try to grow things that grow really well in Alabama. Some of them aren't going to do so well, you know, because you just, you don't have that. There's a body of knowledge that builds up among people who remain in place for generations, traditional knowledge, because they've been around, they've been through it, they've watched what happens, they've seen the consequences, they've passed these down to their children and their grandchildren. This gets lost when people shift around, when they move. You can't rely on your traditional knowledge in a place where you don't traditionally belong. So this is a problem. There's consequences to it, you know. In the 70s, especially the early 70s, there was a great deal of anger and resentment toward people from California around here. A lot of that had to do with the problems that came with the people who were moving in, you see. So on one end, they tended to be quite a bit wealthier than the local people, which drove up the land prices, you see. You'd get retirees from Southern California selling their houses down there for very high prices, coming up here and buying much cheaper places and being willing to pay higher prices than most people around here could for that. So there was that resentment. But there was also the problem of people not understanding local customs, local ways of doing things. If you come from a Southern California suburban tract place, and now you're in charge of 5 acres out in the country, you can't treat that like you did your little lot with the redwood fence around it, you know, and get along with your neighbors quite, you know, the way you used to. So some places that had been used traditionally for generations, you know, for berry picking, for access to go fishing, swimming holes on the river, you know, the people had been doing it for a long time. All of a sudden, what's this? There's a fence up and a gate and a sign that says no trespassing. What the hell's going on here, you know? Well, the new people came, and now they won't, you know, they don't understand. So this created a lot of friction and problems. And so it's, you know, affect things, you know, having respect, you know, just being respectful and being, taking the time to learn and to understand. It's a very difficult thing. It's time consuming. And sustainability, the development of culture that can last and sustain itself, is the work of generations. And if people don't sit still long enough, it's not going to happen. See, it's not going to happen. Instead, you end up destroying what are the culture, the local culture that has developed. Because all genuine culture is local. I mean, it just is. This notion of a global culture, yeah, you know, I mean, okay, yeah, I could talk about the rat race and to somebody who's living in Germany and they know what I'm talking about. You know, this is sort of a global culture kind of thing. But real culture is always local. It's always tied to the land because the land is what sustains us. This is what we've got. This is all we have to live with. We've got air, we've got water, we've got soil, and that's it. That's all we have. And whatever harms those is harmful to us, you know?
Yeah, I appreciated in your book that, and I think you mentioned during, earlier in the interview too, just the getting to know the place, both the physical place and the people who live there. Yeah, like becoming part of the community and, you know, knowing your neighbors and understanding them and being able to have conversations. Yeah, because I think there is this idea of like just going to a different place and wanting to continue more of what you have been doing some other, you know, where you were before. And yeah, you can't necessarily do that. So that's a good point. Thank you so much for being on the show. And yeah, a lot of great kind of like ponderings about life as well as living in this place specifically. So thank you.
sure. Yeah. Well, I'm always glad to help out. And what the heck, if it helps sell a few books too, so much the better.
Awesome. Yeah, no, I really enjoyed reading Over Story Zero specifically, and hopefully I'll check out some of your other books as well.
Yeah, Roseburg Library, all three of them are in there, and I would recommend to you Children of Death, which is my most recent one, and actually a pretty short read. It's the best thing I've ever written. So.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Take care.